Welcome to Recovery Radio by Landmark Recovery with your host, Zach Crouch. In this program, we'll discuss the root causes and treatments of alcohol and substance addiction, speak with experts in related fields, and help navigate the road to recovery. Now, here's the host of Recovery Radio, Zach Crouch.
Hey, everybody. Zach Crouch again, and you're listening to Landmark Recovery Radio, your source for addiction and recovery news and knowledge. The power of second chances. That's what we're going to be talking about today on the episode. And this is really the reason we do what we do at Landmark Recovery. So there's a quote in our home office in Tennessee, as well as some other Landmark Recovery facilities, and it says, "Life always offers you a second chance. It's called today." So if you've been following the podcast the last couple of weeks, you know that we've been focusing on National Recovery Month in the month of September, with the theme being recovery is for everyone, every person, every family, every community. And in a recent episode, it came up in the discussion that people who are in recovery from substance abuse are a loyal and untapped workforce. We're going to talk about that today. Well, today we have one of those guests who will speak directly to second chance employment for recovering addicts and for individuals with prior criminal justice experience. Our guest today is Ty Reed. First of all, Ty is a speaker on the topic of recovery and employment. He's uniquely qualified to work with companies on how addiction, recovery, and the workplace interact. Ty has personal experience as an award-winning salesperson for a Fortune 500 company who lost it all to addiction and then successfully reclaimed his life. Secondly, he runs a nonprofit called Recovery Career Services that provides career coaching to individuals who are in recovery from addiction and homelessness. Ty also teaches organizations how they can spot the signs of substance abuse in the employees and offer support to keep them in their jobs. What a wonderful resume. Ty, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Zach. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
So just to kind of rewind and go back at the very beginning here. So the topic of second chance employment, it's kind of unfortunate when people think or say, you know, this homeless person or drug addict just doesn't want to work. They need to get a job, right? Not to mention when they show up to a job interview and don't have work experience for the last 5 years.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I got to believe that a lot of this is, you know, what we talk about here on the show is breaking down the stigmas. And I'm wondering, can you speak to the obstacles that a person faces when they have been homeless or addicted to substances and they're trying to re-enter the workforce?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, thank you so much for bringing up this really important topic. It is a pretty common misconception that all that would need to happen for someone that has been homeless or who has had some sort of criminal justice involvement or has been facing alcoholism or addiction, the only thing that they really need is to get a job and they can get their lives together. But unfortunately, there are often a whole host of other things that need to be addressed in order for a person to not only get a job, but to keep a job. And I'll use a little part of my experience to relate to this. When I was homeless on the street, I used to often think, man, if my family would just come in and give me $1,000 today, that would fix all my problems. And the truth is that if they'd give me $1,000, that $1,000 would have been gone right away. And I would have had all the same problems I had before, because it wouldn't have done anything to address kind of the underlying issues that were existing for me that caused me to be in that condition in the first place. So while employment certainly is a part of the equation for someone who has been experiencing homelessness or has been unfortunately, you know, connected to addiction or alcoholism, it's not the whole thing. And quite often there's these wraparound services that are also necessary to help get folks back to a point where they are ready to get into the workforce and to hold on to that job. And those wraparound services can be a variety of things. They can be mental health, treatment. They can be things like family treatment, because addiction and alcoholism and certainly homelessness can be a family disease in the sense that it affects, or family conditions in the sense that it affects everybody in the family, not just the individual. And that stigma that you kind of mentioned is also a part of the equation, because so often those same people that are pointing to that homeless person or the person who's addicted and saying that person needs to get a job are the very same people that when they're given an opportunity to provide employment for someone who is recovering from those conditions, will not provide them with an opportunity because they look at their history and say, well, I can't trust this person because they were previously addicted or they were previously homeless or have been in the criminal justice system. So it's kind of a double-edged sword as far as the challenges that folks face. But some of the biggest challenges that I run into when I speak with clients who are in the process of rebuilding their lives really kind of has to do with the internal struggles that all people face on a daily basis, but they can be especially significant for those of us who are in early recovery or have been previously involved in homelessness or the criminal justice system. And a lot of that is, do I deserve to be sober? Do I deserve to be able to rebuild my life? Do I have the skills necessary to be able to do this and really have a life that's of any quality? How do I get started? What are the challenges going to be? How do I overcome those challenges? Those are some pretty big questions to answer when you're coming from a place where you may literally have lost everything and are now trying to look at how to rebuild your life. It can be kind of overwhelming.
I appreciate all that. And one of the things that came up for me as you were talking is, put this down, is this idea of these underlying issues that you brought up, right? And I gotta believe, because we live in a culture now where the resources to understand the problem of things like mental illness, homelessness, even, which most people who are homeless have some sort of mental health issue, right?
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, is it from a perspective of someone like yourself or even me, we have stability in our lives now. I've been sober for a long time. Is it because, in America, we just don't want to get messy? Like we don't want to dig into the issue too much because it's uncomfortable to talk about and unpack if it doesn't involve like maybe our immediate family or even our extended family. If it's just, as long as we can talk about those people over there, it doesn't really, like they got the problem, not me. Right. Is there any of that from your perspective?
Well, I think there is definitely some, a level of discomfort with addressing these issues, as you mentioned, especially if it's not involving a direct family or family member or loved one. But I think there also there's this really interesting thing that happens in American culture. While there's certainly a lot of people who are showing compassion and empathy and working in this space, part of the story of America is that you pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah, right.
And if you're down and in a situation that you should be able to stand on your own, you're an island, you can do it by yourself. And the truth is, what I really deal in is comeback stories. And I get to be a part of somebody offering their own comeback story. And if you see a comeback story, nobody ever does it alone. There's always a significant figure or a group of people that step up to help the individual who's making that comeback. And I kind of like to frame it that way because it points to a couple of things. Again, it points to this idea that really, it kind of takes a village to help a person come back. And, comeback stories are about a bunch of stuff. They're about resilience and overcoming adversity, which shows the very best of the person who is on that comeback journey. They're also about compassion and empathy and lending a helping hand for the people that, magically, I'm going to say magically in air quotes, which you can't see right now,
right.
Magically appear in people's lives who are on that comeback journey at just the right time to help them in that. And so it really gives humanity to show the very, very best of who we are from an overcoming adversity standpoint and the standpoint of showing compassion and empathy. But it also, this is about forgiveness. And that is another huge part of the story. The person making the on that comeback journey kind of has to forgive themselves in a lot of cases for the things that they've done to themselves. And it also requires that society in general have a little bit of forgiveness for the transgressions that that person has perhaps committed, right? To give them another opportunity to rebuild a life and become a contributing member of society. And I think if people can begin to think about things more in those terms, that this is really a comeback story of somebody who's trying to do the right thing, that it might ease some of that stigma and some of the hard feelings and discomfort that people have in discussing these things.
I'm curious to hear also, as you brought that, that's such a great frame, you know, around the idea of forgiveness. And I'm wondering today, you know, in the society and the culture that we live in, are people turned off by that? Like this idea of being a forgiving sort of person, or, you know, in the sense that, like, in the context that you said, bootstrapping it, right? Because if a person can't pull themselves up, you know, they've been given all this opportunity, they have all these advantages, you know, they live in America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the most opportunity of any culture, right? Do we just lose hope in people just because we're like, you know what, they can't, you know, they're beyond help? Have we gotten to that point?
I don't know that we've gotten to that point, but I think we need to be reminded of it. We have a culture, unfortunately, due to a lot of different factors, that now many people spend lots of their time just waiting for somebody to make a mistake so they can pounce on them and be uncompromising and unforgiving and bring up things that they did 10 or 15 years ago to impugn the person that they are today. But a lot of what I do, I really feel like it is reminding individuals of the need for compassion and empathy, and reminding them that they probably know somebody in their lives who has had to go through this process. And I'm sure that you have found this in folks that you talk to as well. When I do presentations or I do speeches and I ask people in the audience, you know, if raise your hand if you know someone who has been impacted by addiction. It's like 80-90% of the people in the audience, right? At least they raise their hands. And then when I start asking questions about, you know, who here knows someone who has been incarcerated or has a criminal record? Again, 80-90% of the people in the audience. And so when I can reframe it in that way and make it more personal to someone who's close to them or someone that they have experience with, I find that that softens people quite a bit. And, you know, you kind of ask the question about whether people are receptive to this idea of forgiveness and compassion and empathy. I frankly think people are looking for an excuse. They're looking for reasons to be helpful to others and to help people that are doing the right thing. They can sometimes be hesitant to do it because they may have been burned in the past. One of the most interesting things to me about living my life out loud as a person in recovery is that it's kind of like living your life out loud as a person who comes out and says that I believe in God in this country, right? So if you come out to a group, if you say to a group of people, I believe in God, it's always going to have one of two effects. There's going to be some people who are listening who are going to draw closer to you, and there's going to be some people who are listening that's going to push them away from you. For me, it's the exact same thing with recovery. When I tell people that I'm an addict in recovery, it's the same thing. Some of them are closer to me because of the experiences they've had either themselves or with their loved ones. And some people, because of the experiences that they've had with themselves or their loved ones, they feel more alienated from me. But there's nothing I can really do about that. And what I encourage people to do is just live your truth. And I think as more and more of us, certainly as you folks at Landmark do it with this radio podcast, and as more people in general do, as more of us who are in recovery and have rebuilt our lives start to talk about it openly, it helps to break down that stigma, right?
Absolutely. Well, in coming back to what you said earlier, this whole idea, and I've heard this time and time again, of the deserving piece. Like, do I really deserve to be, I would say, in a position of, you know, striving rather than surviving, okay, my own life, you know, deserve to be sober, I think is what you said, right? And yeah. I think there's a good number of people that go through, I think their own lives, and they are sober now, but perhaps they don't think that they should be able to be in a position where they go beyond maybe, I'm going to say their own family that they came from, their own family of origins, you know, level of, name it, whatever it was, you know, that you grew up in. And it's almost like for some people, like that survive in war, you know, this idea of survivor's guilt, you know, the people, you know what I'm saying? Right. And I'm wondering if you could talk to the audience a little bit about what you've seen in your experience, you know, having worked with people who are trying to get back into the workforce. You know, what are some of the things that come up for them about, you know, maybe around the idea of being excellent at something, you know, do they have a hard time, you know, with believing that they could do something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that you bring up about survivor's guilt is so true. The other thing that I see a lot is imposter syndrome. You know, people, and so not so much at the very beginning of the journey, but people get into the journey a year or 2 years and life has gotten significantly better. They're no longer scraping by for the very basics. They're relatively stable in their housing. They're stable in their employment life. They're getting some financial stability. And then it becomes a battle of, is this really who I am? Because, you know, perhaps this person was living a different way, a significantly worse way for so long. And that is typically the next battle. And so there's a lot of, luckily employers are getting to the point now where it is relatively easy for somebody who has had an absence from the workforce for addiction, homelessness, or past criminal justice involvement to get kind of that first job, that first kind of entry level, the same type of work we might have had in high school. Those types of jobs are out there for folks that are coming back from these conditions, but it's that next level of job. So how do people in a particular mindset go from that entry level position and prepare themselves where they think that they are capable of and deserving of taking that next step in their lives? And this goes back to a little bit of what we discussed before, the underlying conditions that led people to being in those tough circumstances before, which is kind of what you were talking about with family of origin stuff, right? So this is not necessarily, you know, this type of work is not something that I focus on doing, but it is a discussion that I have with people just so I can tell them that it's something they may want to dig into a little bit in therapy or with a trusted advisor to figure out what might be holding them back from taking that next step and making sure that they know that they are deserving of building whatever life that they want.
All right, I appreciate all that. And I'm curious to also hear from your perspective from the employment side, when some of these employers are, you know, when it comes to hiring, I guess, or helping them, you know, return to the workforce, following things like rehab, are you seeing more employers being intentional about this, you know, who are doing that? Or are you just kind of like trailblazing a path for these folks?
Well, I actually think that employers are, they're starting to move in the right direction. And a lot of this has been spurred on by state government, actually. So in my home state of Washington, and I think in about 20 plus other states in the country, they have gone to, you know, some form of what we call a fair chance in hiring policy. And what those policies tend to do is they outline when and how employers can ask about someone's potential past criminal justice involvement or their history if they've got job gaps and things like that. So the net effect is that folks who may have some of these more unique backgrounds end up getting more interviews. But the next piece of it is the piece that I spend a lot of time working on is, so now we've got state policies that line up to provide interview opportunities and perhaps employment opportunities for people from these challenged backgrounds. And we've got employers that are actually interviewing them, but the next step is the hearts and minds of those hiring managers and supervisors who get a chance to interview these folks. And then if they find out that they're in recovery or have had past criminal justice involvement, what do they think about that? because ultimately it still takes somebody to make a decision that they're going to provide an opportunity for an individual for them to actually get hired. And that's the battle now. So again, I think we're moving in the right direction. The Society for Human Resource Management, SHRM, as some people know them by, or most people know them by, has really done a great job of talking about second chance hiring and second chance employment from both an employer and a job seeker standpoint. And they've really helped kind of move the ball down the field towards, you know, more employers being aware of how important this is. And again, it's really now it's a hearts and minds battle. So I'm glad that I in many ways, I don't have to trailblaze in this area, specifically when it comes to folks that are needing a second chance. The area where I actually do find myself needing to trailblaze, because not a lot of people are talking about it, are the working professionals who still have their jobs, but those jobs have been impacted by their substance use in some way. So they're failing at work because they're drinking too much and not showing up on time, or they have to go to rehab. Right. Now they leave the company, they come back to the company after rehab, and now they're trying to navigate what for them in many ways is an entirely new world, and they got a lot of stuff on the line. So now they're trying to navigate, you know, perhaps being abstinent from drugs and alcohol while also being in a workplace where they might have screwed up before, and this might be their last chance. So there's no formal support set up for employees who are in that situation. So a lot of what I do these days is talk to groups of employers or groups of managers about how they can provide support for those employees. And through through my nonprofit, we provide a coaching program that can coach those individuals if that's the direction that they want to go. But that's really where the trailblazing is happening now, is in that area.
Do you see, at least as far as that's concerned, with your conversations with these managers, that many of them either A, don't know how to have a conversation with the employee about seeking out help, or B, they're so constricted by their own policies and procedures that they can't have a conversation with them because it goes against, you know, any, policy. If they have a drug problem or alcohol problem, like they're to be terminated.
Well, I'm just going to say the word yes to all of that. primarily what I find that the biggest concerns that come from managers and employers around this really comes from number one, a place of caring. So I always start every conversation by assuming that they care about their employees. They want the best for them. They want them to be their best at home and at work. And everything that they're doing is coming from a place of compassion. So it's not that they don't care about the employee or want to keep them as whole and healthy people. It really comes from uncertainty. About, you know, what can I talk to them about? You know, what is proper for me to address, and how do I do that? Uncertainty about what happens if they do leave the company and they have to go to rehab, and uncertainty about how to effectively engage them when they come back to the company and try to, you know, reacclimate them to the workplace. So there's a lot of uncertainty that I think comes with that. There also is, you know, again, I think there is a lesson or some education that needs to happen around what is the right amount of effort to put into keeping an employee versus letting an employee go. So, you know, today there's obviously a lot of
news. Can you get some examples about that, Ty? Can you talk to us a little bit about that, what you've seen in your experience, just about, you know, when it's time to let someone go versus when it's time to really, you know, put the throttle on and get some support behind a person?
Well, it really is on a company by company basis, but you know, a couple of things that I've seen examples where an employee, a longtime employee for a company, has an alcohol problem, for example, and the company absolutely does everything they can to encourage that employee, up to and including sending the employee to a detox multiple times, sending the employee to rehab multiple times. Even after finding the employee drunk on the job, giving the employee another chance, and really doing absolutely everything that the company can to stay invested and connected to this employee, not only because this person had value as a long-term employee, but because the company was so invested in seeing that employee succeed in life. I've seen those examples. On the other hand, I've also seen examples of employees who maybe have a substance issue that they blow a big opportunity for the company. They blow a big presentation. They don't show up for something with a client when they're supposed to. And the company maybe gives them one warning and then they terminate them. And it is always a very, but, it, you know, that also, those are also two examples of one company knowing for sure that the employee has an issue. And the other company doesn't know if the employee has an issue. They just simply terminate them for performance. And in many cases, a manager or an employer, they may have some suspicion that the employee has some sort of outside issue going on, but they're not always going to know. And legally, they really shouldn't ask. Whatever a manager or an employer engages a discussion with an employee that they think may have some outside issue happen, legally what they're advised to do is keep it focused on performance. And unless that employee self-discloses, don't get into any discussion about alcohol or drugs. Unless, of course, you walk into the bathroom and you see the employee doing cocaine off the counter, right?
And that's so because, I mean, this may sound like a dumb question, but why? You know, why? Because of potential lawsuits, legal litigation, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Wrongful termination. And let's face it, these are the only people that are really qualified to diagnose an alcoholic or an addict as an alcoholic or an addict are medical professionals. And perhaps the alcoholic or the addict themselves. So managers and employers have no business being in the space of deciding whether an employee is an alcoholic or an addict or has a substance problem. Now, again, there may be outside signs, but from a legal standpoint and to shield themselves from liability, they really shouldn't get into that. They should keep it focused on job performance. And then if the employee discloses that they're having a substance issue, well, then the employer has some other stuff they may be obligated to do, like if they have health insurance, offer them treatment or offer them FMLA so they can take a leave and address this and perhaps still stay within the company. But without actual knowledge of it, they should talk about it as little as possible. As a matter of fact, not at all is what I would advise.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back just a minute about this idea, though. We talked about it in the intro on how the employee who is in the recovering spot, you know, in a place of recovery, sobriety, how they are a loyal and untapped workforce. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So there were some studies that recently came out that showed that, first of all, folks that have had previous criminal justice involvement or people that are in recovery tend to stay with companies longer than those who haven't had those kind of backgrounds. And it kind of makes sense about why people might be so loyal. They're loyal because when you haven't been given a lot of opportunities and someone presents you with an opportunity, typically you're pretty grateful for that and you're going to work really hard and you're going to be pretty loyal to that company. The other reason, which isn't a great reason, but is also true, is that those folks simply might have fewer options. So they may have fewer options to go to a competitor or to look for a position that pays, a couple of dollars more per hour. So they're going to stay as a result of that as well. And, when people talk about this workforce being untapped, there's lots of places that cite this statistic, but I'm going to cite one from the FBI. And the FBI says that about 70 million adults in this country have some sort of criminal record. So, which is about 1 in 3. One in three and a half adults in this country have a criminal record. So what that says is there's this huge pool of people who have some sort of criminal background, and many of them are being denied employment opportunity. At a time when, before the pandemic, at a time when national unemployment was around 3.5 or 4%, the unemployment rate among those who have previous criminal justice involvement is about 27%. And obviously a lot of folks who may have been incarcerated, and when I say incarcerated, I mean they've spent some time in jail or they've spent time in prison. A lot of those folks will also be people that are in recovery from alcohol and drugs. So you've got this vast kind of untapped, I call them overlooked and untapped pool of talent that's available out there.
Right.
And most of those people, quite frankly, have no current involvement with the criminal justice system. And when I say that, what I mean is they're not on probation, they're not on parole, They're not doing community service, and they're not paying restitution to the courts. So what we have is this huge pool of people who at some point in their lives have had this criminal justice involvement, and now for the rest of their lives, they're just dragging around these criminal histories with them, and they're being denied opportunities over and over again. So for the employers who have the foresight and the willingness to get curious about this population of people, they're going to find a pretty loyal workforce. They're also going to find a workforce or a pool of people who have pretty wide skills. There's going to be people that have never worked before. There's going to be people who have 15 or 20 years of work experience, but they just kind of hit some bumps in the road and kind of need to hit a reset. And they're also going to find less competition from yeah. other companies. Right? So it really kind of solves a lot of problems. But as the other thing that we talked about earlier, there's this stigma in people's minds about what someone who has either been, you know, previously addicted or somebody who has previously been incarcerated in some form, about what those people look like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I do my presentations, one of the things I try to point out to folks is these folks don't look like what you think they look like. I ask people to do this exercise at the beginning.
They look like us.
I ask three questions, you know, in your mind, and there's no right or wrong answer now, in your mind, when you think of someone who's homeless, what's the image that comes to mind? When you think of someone who is an addict, what comes to mind? When you think of someone who's been incarcerated, what comes to mind? And people always have these mental images. And then I say, well, if you didn't include me in that, then I don't think you have a full picture. Yeah. Because at one point in my life, I was all three of those. And
well, talk to us about that, Ty. And I know that you've been there, and I know that our listeners, they would certainly love to know more about your story. But also just how to know that there is hope beyond addiction.
Yeah. My story in capsule is, 2006. I am 2005, 2006. I was a pretty well-compensated business development professional for a Fortune 500 company, and doing pretty well. Married, beautiful wife, beautiful stepdaughter, big brand new house, and had what most people would consider the good life. But mm-hmm. I was also living a second life, which was, so day by day, I'm a professional guy walking through nice offices, talking to nice people, and by night, I was out running the streets, looking for drugs and drinking a bunch. And that eventually spiraled into me either giving away or losing absolutely everything that mattered to me. And by 2014, I was a homeless meth addict living on the streets of Seattle and became a petty criminal, divorced, unemployable, and really didn't have a sense of where my next meal was going to come from or where I was going to sleep next. And I spent from 2014 to 2016 experiencing a variety of fairly unpleasant things. I was in and out of jail multiple times, got committed to a mental institution, also survived a couple of suicide attempts, and was fortunate enough in 2016 to find my way to recovery. And it certainly has not been a straight line, but recovery, it gave me the opportunity to step back and examine all the reasons why I ended up in the place where I was. And I feel really fortunate now to be able to use that experience to help other people. But the reason why I got so connected with this idea around employment came from my own experience.
If I can, one second, Ty, I just want to ask a quick question. So obviously, a lot happens between you're married, you're making great money, to now I'm living on the streets. I'm a meth addict in Seattle, right? Can you walk us down just briefly, maybe the series of events that led to being in that position from being on such a high top place?
So in 2008, financial crisis happens.
Yep.
I lose my high paying job. My marriage falls apart, not too long after that. Not because I lost my job, but simply because, quite frankly, my wife, realized that she'd been sold a bill of goods by me, and I wasn't the person that I told her I was. And so we separated. I went to work for in a different industry. While I was in that industry, I my drug and alcohol use got worse. I went to rehab, returned to work after rehab, and went through a lot of the experiences that I coach people about now. That unfortunately wasn't enough for me. I hadn't learned enough of a lesson to know that I should quit. So I continued for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years to kind of be on a very slow, I call it a slow motion train wreck is really where it was. So for the next 4 or 5 years, I worked, I had moderate success at the places that I went. My personal relationships, especially those with my family, were kind of a mess. Eventually found myself in a situation where I was still trying to live a double life, holding on to this one life that had a bunch of chaos in it, and still trying to be a professional regular guy, but that was becoming more and more difficult because of all the chaos and the drama, right? And super exhausting. Very exhausting. You know, if you think it is, you can get tired at the end of a work week being one person. When you're looking at two people, it ain't great.
No.
So it was, in many ways, I look back and I can't even believe that I not only survived that time, but was able to hold it together for as long as I did, quite frankly. And I'm sure a lot of it was I thought I was holding it together, but to the people outside of me that knew me, they could see that I wasn't holding it together, right?
Wow.
Eventually I got to a place where I got evicted from an apartment and, lost my job in 2014. And, quite frankly, what I felt was not despair, but I felt relief. I felt relief. Yeah, I remember that. I clearly remember that moment. June 26, 2014. I'm standing on the street in Seattle. It's a beautiful day outside. And I have no idea what's going to happen. But I just remember thinking to myself, man, I don't need to try to be that professional guy anymore. Now I can just let go and just be a drug addict. And I can just run the streets. And in a moment when I should have, like so many other moments in my life, when I should have been examining how I got there and what I could do to start to turn life around, I just kept on going down that road because I finally had the responsibilities that I'd been trying to maintain for so long, but I found so taxing I no longer had. And that 2 year period, that 2014 to 2016 of living on the streets, trying to get sober, going through all this, I had another stint in rehab in 2015, which I failed spectacularly, went back to the streets. And, it really was key to me finally recognizing, the damage that I was doing to myself and to other people. And, March 2nd, 2016, I'm sitting in a hotel room with a friend of mine, and I'm getting drunk and I'm getting high. And March 3rd, 2016, I walked into the doors of a 12-step hall and have been connected to it ever since.
Wow.
And I said that my journey to sobriety has not been straight. Alcohol, I haven't had a drink since March 3rd, 2016. Mm-hmm. Drugs were tougher for me to kick. I've been continuously clean and sober since January 26th of 2019. I thought that when I got sober that all my problems would be solved. And it is,
You're not alone.
So there's this metaphor that I don't know if I read it or somebody told it to me at a meeting, but if you've got a drunk horse thief and you sober him up, what do you got? You got a sober horse thief, right? So yes, all the substances have now been removed, but all those underlying character defects and personality traits that cause someone to lie, cheat, and steal in the first place are still there.
Issues and isms.
Yes. And so, I am constantly treating that sober horse thief. That is what I do on a daily basis.
Me too, man.
Right? And
me
so,
too.
You know, that's the work that I get to do. And I, you know, again, I am, I get to do that on a personal level. And I, you know, I feel really honored to be able to use my experience to help other folks who are kind of walking that journey. And, you know, what I, the things that I work with people on have to do with recovery, and some of it is abstinence and sobriety, but really it is, you know, how do we, the thing that I do now, which is how do I prevent alcohol and drugs from having a negative impact on my life?
Mm-hmm.
And the only way for a guy like me is complete abstinence. And so that's, you know, to the best of my ability, that's what I try to do.
As we kind of wind down here, you know, I want to just, and thank you, by the way, for sharing all that. I think it just adds another layer to your story for all of us here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, with closing down, I'm curious to hear, you know, as an employer, you know, what would you say are some of the most important things as an employer that they can do to be more mental health conscious, but also to spot the signs that an employee might have a substance issue? You know, because you said basically, you know, you cannot outright say it or ask the question even. So if you're kind of handcuffed there, even if you have a good relationship with the, with one of your supervisees or whoever that might be, you still can't go there. So what do you do?
Well, there's a couple things. I think now, obviously, you know, you mentioned the relationship that you have with the employee is certainly a part of whether you can say anything. So I just want to be really clear. You know, obviously the rules for if you're working in a family business and you're the dad and you're the owner and you're your son or a close family friend that you've known, you know, have a relationship with outside of the business, maybe that's going to be a different situation. But if we're in a traditional work setting and you know, it's pretty formal roles and a pretty formal hierarchy, that's when I definitely recommend that you should do as little as possible to try to diagnose people or you know, ask them about their substance use, right? From an employer standpoint, I think one of the best things that employers can do is let their employees know that it's okay to not be okay. And because that helps to break down a bit of the stigma. I mean, we're starting to see recently, you know, a lot of big companies are going to, including a wellness statement in the literature that they present to their employees. And that wellness statement is really simple. Basically says, you know, we have mental health resources available. We recognize that sometimes life can be difficult, and we encourage you to take advantage of the resources that we have. And maybe they have a, you know, they have an employee assistance program, or they have something like that. But by creating an environment where people know that it's okay to ask for help if you need it, it can kind of help create some trust. So in that time, when the moment comes when someone actually feels like they have to ask for help, that can make it easier for them to do so.
Totally.
So that's the first thing. So, you know, one of the things I encourage, you know, when I talk to groups of managers, I encourage them in their one-on-ones with their employees to make it about more than just business. Try to build a personal connection. So that at some point, if that employee really is in need, that they feel comfortable asking for help if they need it. And perhaps they don't feel like if they ask for help that their job is automatically going to be in jeopardy, or that they're going to be judged or not get the help that they need. So creating that environment is really the best thing that an employer can do. And there's a few different ways to do that. The wellness statement is one way to do that. Building that personal connection is a way to do that. Also, you know, if I were on a call with a manager and the manager were to read that wellness statement and then say something like, even I sometimes have trouble with things going on these days. And when I need help, I reach out and I get it. And I want to encourage you to do the same thing. Even just a simple statement like that can go a long way towards letting employees know that it's okay to ask for help when they need it. Yeah. As far as you're recognizing the signs, there are always kind of the traditional signs that if you're in a physical environment that employers can recognize, right? So disheveled clothing, smell of alcohol on breath, glassy eyes, stuff like that. In this kind of virtual or remote environment, it can be a little bit tougher, but some of the, you know, kind of basics are, do you have employees who they never have their camera on? Ever.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
On its own, the thing to remember is that these things on their own. So if somebody never has their camera on, it could mean that they're just not a morning person and they didn't, you know, they didn't do their hair, or they didn't, they're not wearing a, they're wearing a t-shirt, right? It could be that, or it could be something else. But if you start to see a pattern, then that's where these things could become red flags. So if they're never ever on camera for virtual meetings, if they can never make an early morning meeting, or you notice that they leave for lunch in the middle of the day, and then they kind of never pop back up. That could be another sign. That could be somebody who is just getting through the morning, and even though they're trying to make it till 5 o'clock in the evening and start drinking, maybe they don't make it. People who kind of disappear on payday. So if they get that paycheck, then all of a sudden either they're out for Friday afternoon, or they can't make it in on Monday morning because Friday afternoon bled into Monday morning. Those are kind of some signs that you can think about. And then of course, if they do show up on a Zoom call, if they are not engaged, if they are glassy-eyed, if they are not making a lot of sense when they talk, these are all kind of things that in a remote environment that employers can look for as signs that maybe there's something going on. And again, you know, one of these on their own could be because of some other factor, but if you see a pattern and you see more than one of these, then there could be something going on.
Got it. Well, I know, Ty, that this is certainly a topic that's become more and more interest in the state of Kentucky, because my impression is that this idea, especially when folks are filling out job applications, you know, the boxes, you know, that you got to check off. There's a lot of shame still around that, you know, and a lot of fear that people, if they check that box, that it's just an automatic disqualification. And would you agree that in some cases that is still the case?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It is. But yeah, I always, and this is what some of these fair chance in hiring laws that we talked about a little bit earlier is what they do. They ban the box. And so they say that no longer can an employer ask an applicant whether they have had previous criminal justice involvement until after they have interviewed them and then determined that they may want to make a job offer. So removing that box goes a long way, but there is certainly a huge stigma attached to that box being there. And I think that, you know, most people know that if an employer sees that they check that box, in a lot of situations, they're just not going to get a call back at all.
Yep. Well, I want to thank you, man, for the work that you're doing in this space. And, you know, if people want to find out more about what Ty is doing, they need to go and check out his website. It's www.recoveryandworks.org. So that's recovery, the word and, work.org. And in closing, I really want to take a second. I want to close out the show today with an inspirational quote from one of our recent Landmark Recovery graduates named Winona. And she said, and I quote, "Landmark truly saved my life. I walked into the doors hopeless and completely broken. And during my stay, I was given so many tools to aid in my recovery. And upon leaving Landmark, I am hungry for recovery and so hopeful for my future in sobriety." So with that said, if you know someone struggling with addiction, there is hope for you. You got to believe that. So here at Landmark, we would like to come alongside you in your recovery journey. You can visit us at landmarkrecovery.com, or you can speak with a recovery specialist 24/7. Simply by calling 888-448-0302. Again, that's 888-448-0302. Again, thanks for everybody for tuning into Recovery Radio. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for tuning in to Recovery Radio. New content for this program is available every Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time, with all episodes available on demand on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel and through our content partners, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play Podcasts. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to create quality content to help save 1 million lives in the next 100 years. You don't need to struggle through addiction alone. Live the life you dreamed on the road to recovery.